Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Okay, you won. Congratulations. Now, what are you going to do about the economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the second day of August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We are going to begin today with two bullet points, both of a theme. Point number one, from this show last Friday, our weekly wrap, in which I asked Felix Salmon what that day's distinctly lousy report on second quarter gross domestic product. And remember, the economy here grew at a subpar 1.2% rate on an annualized basis. I asked Felix what he thought about that.
I just look at these figures. You know what I think?
I don't know.
Japan.
Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two, and I swear we did not set it up this way, but point number two is this morning, the Japanese government, mired deep in its second decade of a stuck economy, announced a big government stimulus program. So, with that in mind, and with the reality that the economy we have today is increasingly likely to be the economy on Inauguration Day, what, pray tell, do the candidates propose to do? Gigi Duban gets us going.
When it comes to infrastructure, the presidential candidates are all about spending. You have Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. As early as the primary, she proposed spending $275 billion over 5 years to help create jobs, among other things. Kent Hughes is a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center.
And she looks at a world in which we have record low interest rates and lots of opportunity in terms of infrastructure.
Opportunity is putting it mildly. One report from the American Society of Civil Engineers said our bridges and parks are in such bad shape, it'd take $3.6 trillion to get them up to date by the year 2020. Republican nominee Donald Trump told Fox Business News Clinton's proposed $275 billion isn't enough.
Well, I would say at least double her numbers, and you're going to really need more than that.
That is so not in line with fiscal conservatives, says Kevin Esterling. He teaches political science at UC Riverside. But he says this is Trump we're talking about.
I think it's just consistent with who he is. It's what he knows. He builds things, right? He wants to build a wall. That's like a major infrastructure expenditure right there.
But let's just say the next president gets to deal with a sluggish GDP growing at about 1.2%. Is spending money on infrastructure the answer?
I mean, it might be the answer just based on long-run growth.
Gabriel Chodorow-Reich teaches economics at Harvard University. He says that spending can boost employment and productivity. But on the flip side, he says it makes the Fed more likely to raise interest rates, which might put a damper on things in the short term. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
I don't want to alarm anybody here, but eventually money is going to go away. Not the idea of money, the idea that you have a means of exchange that's worth something. No, I mean actual money, the currency and the coins. Instant person-to-person electronic payments are the wave of the future, which is why this week a couple of the financial biggies, Bank of America and Wells Fargo among them, formed a digital payments network to catch up with other scrappier players in that space like Venmo and Square Cash. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Customers of several big banks have been able to send money to friends and family digitally for a few years now, but it wasn't until recently, like yesterday in the case of Wells Fargo, that the transaction happened in real time. Here's Wells Fargo spokesman Chris Dahl.
If you're, for example, splitting a dinner check or you're paying a babysitter and you don't have cash or you don't want to use cash, real-time funds availability just takes the money from one account and puts it in the other account within a couple minutes.
That's assuming the recipient banks with a lender in the same payments network. With an app like Venmo, that money may not get to your bank account for a day or two. However, Venmo is really popular among millennials, and banks want millennials' business. Jim Sinegal is an analyst at Morningstar. He says the instant peer-to-peer payments alone won't be especially lucrative for banks, but they serve a strategic purpose.
The idea is that it's a gateway for the more profitable payment transactions.
like merchant transactions, where banks make money on interchange fees. Senegal says the banks want their customers to use them for all those functions and not let PayPal and Venmo take over their turf. Tally Baker is an analyst at IT Group. She says the one disadvantage banks may have, though, is that apps like Venmo seem easier and more fun to use. Wells Fargo's app requires extra steps, like logging in with your bank account and password if you don't have an iPhone with thumbprint identification.
So I think that's the hurdle for banks now. It's them being able to make their apps as frictionless and to sort of have that cool appeal.
I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but today makes it 7 down sessions in a row for the Dow. And you know what? That's okay, y'all. It's okay. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For what appears to be the first time on record, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has issued a warning advising people not to travel to a place inside the continental United States as a precaution against an infectious disease. The place is the community of Wynwood in North Miami, Florida. The disease, of course, is the Zika virus. In all, 14 people are thought to have become infected with Zika as a result of local mosquito bites. That's important, local mosquito bites. Zach Stern is the owner of Zach the Baker Bakery in Wynwood. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me what it's like there now with this news of the travel warning.
Well, it depends. If I go to the main street of Wynwood, it's definitely palpable. You can see all the different newscasts there with their very large antennas, and it feels like there was a murder or something happened. But inside our actual bakery, the day-to-day, you wouldn't really know the difference.
Yeah, people still coming in? I can hear the door opening and closing.
Yeah. Definitely. People are still coming in.
Right. We should say here that your wife is actually pregnant, right? So you've got something else going on here.
Yeah, I have something else going on. That's for sure.
How are you feeling about that? I mean, do you have a sense you can do anything about it, or are you just stuck?
To be honest, I don't really know. You know, I asked my wife what she thinks, and, you know, she was unconcerned. She called her midwife, and her midwife seemed equally unconcerned. And so all that unconcern got me concerned. So I called my physician and I asked him, and, you know, he gave me a pretty reasonable response. It wasn't sensational and it wasn't conspiratorial. He basically said, hang on, you know, we don't know just yet. My wife's 7 months pregnant. So, you know, the unknown nature of it certainly stirs up a bit of fear. I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm looking for that. What's that reasonable response? What's that in between my midwife's conspiracy ideas and in between what I read on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today? You know, where should I be and what should my response be?
Given that you got a business and that's where your life is, I imagine part of that response doesn't involve leaving, right?
Leaving's never a choice. We run a wholesale bakery and this is a beast. It just keeps going. You know, I'm more concerned, to be honest, with changing my air filters so our AC keeps working in the middle of the summer here in Miami.
Yeah.
So it hasn't reached the front burner. It's back there just because I hear the buzz and everyone wants to know, but it's certainly way in a back burner right now.
Zach Stern of Zach the Baker in the Wynwood section of Miami. Zach, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Today in Correlation is Not Causality, this item, citizenship applications by green card holders were up about 6% the first 6 months of this fiscal year, that is, since last October, and that's as compared to the same period in 2012 during the last presidential election cycle. It's tempting but wrong to say more people are becoming citizens because of this year's interesting contest. Applications go up and down for lots of reasons, not the least of which is how much it costs to become a citizen. Lucia Benavidez reports from Austin, Texas.
This is the sound of $680 being spent.
We're going to go ahead and start the process with your left hand, four fingers.
That's the cost of the first steps of the citizenship process, filing the application and going to the biometrics appointment. You get your fingerprint scanned.
Please look straight at the camera. You can smile, but don't show any teeth.
Then it's a quick photo. A few months later, an interview, a civics test, no fee for those. And congratulations, you're an American.
And you have a good day. Thank you.
But that's if your case is straightforward. If you need a lawyer, well...
I can say that it will be more than probably $1,000, and then average will be from $1,000 to $5,000.
That's immigration attorney Iris Albizu. She has a busy practice in Austin, where there's a large Latino population who'd like to become citizens. She says that much money means some people can't afford to apply, which is why she offers a payment plan. Most people go to lawyers if they have complicated cases, if they were ever in trouble with the law, for example, or held undocumented status for a time. Everything in your history will come up, even something like getting caught for underage drinking.
Applying for citizenship seems like a very easy process, but it's a process that they take it very seriously. They review all your moral character, they review all your record, they review how you became a resident in the first place.
Graduate student May Mosaic is originally from Syria and is now at the University of Texas. Her family in Tennessee didn't use a lawyer when they applied last year, but she still had to travel back there for her first appointment and then did a lot of waiting around for her second appointment.
A lot of people were always just like, you know, citizenship isn't so hard. Like, you just have to take a little test. So I don't think that they realize how hard it is and how time-consuming and how much money you spend on it.
In all, her family spent $4,500 for four applications, which included her plane tickets and 2 months' rent for her empty house in Texas. But she doesn't stop there. Mosaic says the cost of citizenship should also take into account the money spent on visas and green cards. After all, you need to go through that process to qualify for citizenship. For her family, that was more than $30,000.
My college fund and my sister's college fund that my dad had worked on his whole life was just gone to the lawyers so we could stay.
For 6 months, Mosaic obsessively checked her application status online. She worried something could go wrong and delay the process.
I made sure to ask the woman that I was interviewing me, are you sure I'm going to get it like within 6 months? And she said yes, because I really want to vote in November elections.
Mosaic got her wish. Her citizenship came through in time to vote for the primaries. Others may not be so lucky. Because of the rise in applications, there's a backlog at the immigration office. So for some, it will be a nail-biting wait to see if they can squeeze in and make it to the polls in time. In Austin, I'm Lucia Benavides for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Certainly hasn't been boring. We've had no shortage of things to do, that's for sure.
Angie's List, the turnaround plan straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 90 points today, 0.4%, closed at 18,313. The NASDAQ down 46 points, about 0.9%, 5137. The S&P 500 off 13.6, 0.6%, 2157 there. U.S. automakers hit a speed bump today after Ford and General Motors reported sales were down in July. Ford, GM, and Chrysler, Fiat Chrysler, all shifted down more than 4%. In healthcare, Biogen's pulse sped up a bit on reports that the drug giants Merck and Allergan may be interested in acquiring the company. Biogen's share zoomed up 9.3%. Merck declined about 0.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.55%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here's a thought. If you're tired of the treacly Olympics coverage that American networks usually provide, why not just watch on YouTube? Google is sending 15 YouTube stars to Rio to live stream from there, a whole new kind of press corps with a whole new kind of built-in audience, as Marketplace's Sally Herships reports.
Before we go any further, an important question. Are these journalists or are they personalities?
Well, this is the big question about social media in general.
Jonah Berger teaches marketing at Wharton. He says we are seeing a big shift from traditional journalistic outlets to YouTube, Instagram, Vine. Exhibit A, Bob Costas.
Some athletes.
Exhibit B, one of the YouTube team, Brody Smith. He's famous for playing Frisbee. One of his videos has 37 million views. Berger says even if you or I haven't heard of them, you would not believe how popular some of YouTube stars are. And their millions of followers will follow them to Rio virtually.
Are they able to report on things happening? Certainly. Are people getting as much from their coverage? Well, that's not entirely clear.
But one thing that is clear, Berger says in some senses, YouTube is trying to kill television.
YouTube is hoping to be your one-stop shop for any sort of entertainment. No longer will you need an actual television except to watch things on YouTube.
Betsy Page Sigman is at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. She says Google owns YouTube, so not only will it be creating content, it will also help users search for Olympic coverage with special features, like a sports tab.
And the sports tab is going to list all the 42 distinct disciplines that are out there and talk about previously awarded medals by team and athlete.
The sports tab will also be a magnet for search ads, which could allow Google to bring home a different kind of gold. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Angie's List. Remember them? You need a plumber or a carpenter or a locksmith or a chimney sweep. They've got reviews for all of them. But the internet economy of today isn't the internet economy of 20 years ago when Angie Hicks started that company. So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, the newish CEO of Angie's List, Scott Derschlag, and how he is going to adapt. Scott, it's good to talk to you.
Great to be here, Kai.
You've had this job for a little less than a year now, I guess. Has it been what you've expected?
It's been more than I expected. It's been a tremendous opportunity to transform a company that was iconic in the home services space. And it certainly hasn't been boring. We've had no shortage of things to do, well, that's for sure.
Well, let's pick up on the past tense reference to was iconic. I mean, when Angie's List started, everybody was like, oh, yeah, this is a great idea. And then, honestly, it's like, oh, yeah, Angie's List is still around, you know?
Yeah, and that's part of what attracted me to take the job, to be honest with you. It's been around for 20 years, and the brand has got extraordinary reach and power. I mean, it's got 56% unaided awareness, so it's right up there with, Nike.
Come on, really?
In the home services space, it is identified with it. It really is. And that's not a small thing. Because the home services space is a $400 billion space. Yeah. And I looked at the website and I thought, well, it's kind of stuck in 2002. Huh. You know, it needed a fresh look, I think. And frankly, user expectations have just gone way up, right? The Airbnbs and Ubers and Facebooks have caused the bar to go up on what consumers sort of demand for a good experience online, and Angie's List didn't keep up with that.
And we should say here that you guys have recently dropped the paywall. You now offer a free service where you can read reviews, and then you got a bunch of tiered things. I do want to pick up on what I've read that you said, a quote of yours. 90% of millennials said they would never pay for content under any circumstance, and you said, you know, you can't fight gravity. We got to be on board this train.
Right. I wanted to embrace that because the great thing about millennials is they want to be part of something bigger than themselves and they want to contribute back to a community. Well, that's great for a reviews company. And so I looked at it and said, time to drop the paywall for reviews. Huh. And we did that. We did that and have had extraordinary results. I mean, we've seen more than four times as many members joining us since we took down the paywall, and we've seen them really active in their engagement. And that's really reassuring because, you know, the worst thing that could have happened, right, my nightmare would have been to drop the reviews paywall and nobody cares. And that's not at all what happened.
How then, and this might be an opportune time to pause for a little finance here, how do you make money having just dropped the paywall and looking for growth that way?
So the business model shifts towards making more money from the service providers. But we also are not giving up on the consumer side. I also kept two premium tiers, and we are offering real benefits. For example, if you want to have the ability to have us intervene on your behalf with a service provider if there's a problem, you need to be one of the premium members. We're bringing out other services like a home emergency services line where we'll make sure that you get a response within a couple of hours if your basement floods. And, it's clear to me from the research that we did that those are benefits that are truly valued, and there's a segment that's willing to pay for those things. This is, after all, your most precious asset. It's your home.
So in 5 years, then, are you all more than a review company with a couple of ancillary service type things? And have you grown it into a much more service-based operation? Is that the plan?
Yeah, the plan that I outlined to investors in March had three parts. The first part was to fix the core business, but that's not enough. The second part of it really relates to taking advantage of this platform. But where I really want to go, if you're talking a five-year time frame, is into the third part, which is where we become the first dedicated, purpose-built home services marketplace that just automatically knows what you need done around your home and schedules that and dispatches it. That's a big opportunity. I've said that between now and 2020, that gives us the opportunity to build, about a $750 million business. Why wouldn't we do that?
Scott Derschlag, he is the CEO at Angie's List. Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
My full interview with Scott Derschlag is out today on our Corner Office podcast. You can get it at marketplace.org or at your podcast provider of choice. Besides the gymnastics and the track and field and all the other old reliables, there's a sport making a long-awaited return to the Olympic Games this time around. Golf is going to be in the competition for the first time since 1904. But a lot of high-profile golfers have decided to keep their clubs in the bag, as it were. Zika has been mentioned as a concern, yes, but as Jimmy Jenkins reports, there are some economic forces at work here as well.
At the Arizona State University practice range, sophomore golfer Gino Sohn is working on his irons.
Just trying to keep it simple, make sure everything's on plane and that I'm not coming too far from the inside.
Sohn started golfing when he was 8 years old, and growing up, he dreamed about competing at the highest level of the game.
Major championships, the Masters, US Open, PGA Championship.
While he fantasized about putting on the green jacket, he never envisioned himself standing on an Olympic podium. That's because golf has been absent from the Olympics for more than 100 years. But that drought comes to an end this year in Rio. Ty Votaw is the vice president of the International Golf Federation. He led an effort to successfully lobby the International Olympic Committee for golf's return back in 2009.
The primary reason we thought that it would be beneficial for our game was that it would grow the sport around the world, both on a participation level and on a fan level.
And they had help making their case from some of the biggest names in the game at the time.
We were fortunate to have players like Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, to participate in our presentations.
But recently, Olympic support among golf superstars has been flagging.
I didn't get into golf to try and grow the game. I got into golf to win.
That's Rory McIlroy speaking in a press conference on his decision to skip the Rio Olympics. He's one of five of the top 10 golfers in the world that have dropped out. While health concerns may play a role, golf agent Barry Meister says there are many reasons golfers choose to play or not play. One major factor, money.
It's like any business. You figure out what you need to earn, you figure out what your budget will be, and then you figure out the best way to make your nut in terms of your scheduling.
And Rio comes at an inconvenient time in a full summer schedule. Joel Shookman with the PGA says the few remaining tournaments are the last chance for golfers to qualify to play on tour next year.
It's a delicate balance because we have a money list. We don't have guaranteed contracts, so these guys, to keep their playing status for the following year, have to make a certain amount of money.
Golfers have to stay in the top 125 in the rankings or receive a special exemption to play in tour events. Shookman says the earnings from one win can mean the difference between players keeping their tour card or looking for a new job.
If you're the winner, you take home 18% of the purse, and that's, you know, you're going to make seven figures.
So while a strong showing in Rio might be good for the game, it won't do anything for the players' standings on tour. Despite the loss of some star power this year, golf advocates negotiated a place in the Olympics through at least the 2020 games in Tokyo. Ty Votaw with the IGF thinks it was the right play.
The results that we're seeing here in the short term, I think, will ultimately result in a long-term growth trajectory for our sport.
But Votaw concedes it may take a while before players and fans decide that Olympic golf is truly up to par. In Phoenix, I'm Jimmy Jenkins for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Apple weighs in, symbolically anyway, on the gun debate in this country. The company announced yesterday that when iOS 10 rolls out in the fall, the handgun emoji is going to be replaced by a green plastic-looking toy water pistol, which I believe is not covered in the Second Amendment. All right, we got to go, which is all right because we're basically out of stuff. The Dow gave up 90 points today, 0.4%, 18,313. The NASDAQ fell 46 points, 0.9%, 51-37. The S&P 500 down 13 points, 0.6%, 21.57 there. Tommy Andres and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on the Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.